The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. We're coming to you all the way from Singapore, which is immensely exciting. By the time this will have been published, it'll have been ATS will have been over and done with, and we'll all have dreadful hangovers. So welcome, everyone. Our special guest today, Finn Hindman, who is a digital consultant specializing in many things, but amongst others, live commerce at the moment. Hi, Finn. How are you doing?
Hi. Good. Excited to have you here in town.
Yeah, well, we're very excited to be here. So thanks very much for making some time to join the podcast. And my trusty colleague joins me, Lindsay Roundtree. How you doing, Lindsay?
Hi there. I was doing karaoke last night, so my voice is a little bit gone, but great to be back in Singapore. I've missed it terribly.
Regular listeners will know that there's a little bit of a relationship between, shall we say, ATS events or ExchangeWire travelling events and karaoke and no voices.
And lost voices. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a common theme for me.
Indeed.
I don't learn.
Do any of us. Right, let's crack on. First news story of the day that I wanted to chat through with the two of you is a study from Digital TV Research, who are a UK-based research consultancy, has showed that APAC SVOD subscriptions, so that is because we always like to make sure we're getting the right acronym associated with the right activity, subscription video on demand. So APAC SVOD subscriptions market has grown by is the size of 541 million in 2021 and is set to grow to 750 million in the next 5 years, which is pretty hefty. China makes up 49% of that market and India accounts for 23%. And it's estimated that the international SVOD providers that we're probably all quite familiar with across global markets, Netflix, Disney Plus, HBO Max, Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV Plus, are only going to make up a quarter of that market, which is quite interesting. Begs the question what local players might be entering the market. But the research study also says that this is attributed somewhat to the lack of access to the Indian and Chinese market. However, it should be noted that Netflix's main rival, Disney Plus, I should say Netflix's main rival perhaps in global markets, Disney Plus has had a bit of success entering the Indian market with their partnership with Hotstar. So some quite interesting little nuggets of data and information in this report. My first question to you guys, and I'm going to start with you here, Finn, is what does this sort of explosive growth in SVOD say about the streaming TV marketplace in APAC? Is it a scenario where we're going to see, the increase in subscription uptake really open out opportunities for international players to enter the market or other local players to enter the market? And I suppose, do you also think it's going to fuel a greater sense of fragmentation across the industry? Because it seems that once we move to once we start seeing an uptick in subscription services, then everybody's on the bandwagon.
Yes.
Three questions in one. Classic Rachel Smith compound question.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So I think the first thing for me that jumps out when looking at this is, are we really comparing potatoes and potatoes here? If you look at Disney and Hotstar, and you know they're very based on the TV base that Disney had versus Netflix, who are a purely online player. They're very different offerings. One is more akin to Sky in the UK, and people who are looking at their app, and especially given the cricket and the sport that's driven a lot of Disney's uptake. I'm not sure if you were talking about this in the UK, if you would compare Netflix and Sky's app. I don't know.
No.
They'd be completely different,
yeah,
right? Because it's just cable
it's
via
box
an app.
Versus exactly. CTV.
Right. And I think that's actually, you said, like, what's the explanation for the growth? And I think what we're seeing more and more in APAC is this is and has always been touted as a mobile-first region. And I think you're seeing the delivery of cable just by any other device. I was listening to another podcast the other day.
You listened to other podcasts?
I did listen to another podcast.
How dare you?
It was talking about, you know, if only we had one box that could take all these subscriptions that we pay one fee for and give us all of the content instead of all of these apps and all of these subscriptions. It's literally, I think, where we've gotten to in APAC is it's cable. It's just delivered through an app.
That's interesting.
So I think the growth... I think it would be more sensible to start separating people. So Netflix is maybe more akin to local players like View, who are an APAC player who have 60 million subscribers. You know, that's a decent number. I think Netflix is about 70 million on this side of the world, versus Disney, where you've got the cricket. I mean, the cricket in India... And the subscription price and the fact that a lot of their subs are baked in with telcos and things like that.
They have just lost the IPL, haven't they? Did I read that?
They lost the IPL and they've just... So Paramount, Viacom have got the IPL. Right. And then Disney have just bid another bucket load of money for the next grade down of cricket. So,
which will still be massive, right?
Right. It's still huge. Again, comparison to the UK for me is always footy, and you've got the Prem and then you've got the Championship and the all the other leagues that make up the rest of the football pyramid. So I don't think the Disney-Netflix comparison is fair in terms of subscriber value, in terms of the base that they're coming from, in terms of the partnerships that are there. All of that said, and kind of ignoring those reasonably useful facts, yeah, I think there is the explosion. I think we're going to see more and more. I think as a consumer, I want to see more of the other non-APAC players launching, because one of the things that's really weird is you sit in APAC and you see all of the content that's created and the amount of money spent on all this amazing original content, and loads of it you sit here you actually can't get. So you can't get Lifetime, you can't get some of the Paramount apps, you can't get some of that content here legally. So it's weird. We see this explosion in numbers on one side, and we see an explosion in content and great content being created, but we're not getting access to it.
Lindsay, potatoes and potatoes, or potatoes and apples?
Potatoes and potatoes.
That's kind of what I was going for, but I kind of lost the fruit thing halfway.
Oh, no, I quite like it.
I was going to say, I've not heard of potatoes versus potatoes before.
Yeah, but, it's good. Yeah. I like it.
I'll use it. I think that is a good point, because, and I think that whenever you talk about SVOD or anything related to any kind of CTV, it's normally talked about with a very US lens, and it forgets and ignores that every other region in the world is extremely fragmented. Europe is very fragmented. Latin America is very fragmented. APAC is even more fragmented. And what fascinates me about APAC, and I have the benefit here of I'm moderating the TV panels. I've had some wonderful chats with my panelists about kind of CTV in APAC and data-driven TV in APAC. And for me, the fascinating thing is the fragmentation is not going to become less fragmented. It'll become more fragmented. And I wonder, and you just mentioned that you would like other content from outside of APAC to come into this region. Will we see the likes of Pluto start opening up in this region now that Netflix and Disney have had success, and you've got Paramount and HBO Max and Amazon Prime Video and Apple TV? Will more of them go, well, actually, there's a market here, but I cannot enter this market with a cookie cutter approach. I have to look at how the APAC market consumes content, why it's mobile first, how I make sure that everything I'm producing is catered towards mobile first offering. SVOD as well is always a tricky one, because they don't want to pay the money, and they're happy to, with the value exchange of advertising. So, you know, Netflix and Disney are both going down the ad-funded route globally. What that looks like here will have to be different from what it looks like in the rest of the world anyway, because of the relationship and the value exchange with ads versus not ads. So I think the interesting thing there is the fragmentation, but also the explosion of content. And we've got somebody from True Digital, a Thai CTV platform, speaking on the panel. They've just launched in other Southeast Asian markets, and they're launching this content, and everything has to be translated or everything has to be subtitled and dubbed. And it's like you're catering to so many different markets with one platform. That has to be thought about. And that's something I think that you know, in the US, they're quite used to doing that in English and Spanish, but it goes so far beyond that. Are they ready to enter the market?
Well, I mean, that's surely the argument. A few years ago, it was talking about how Netflix are trying to enter the APAC market and that they were looking to those markets for subscriber growth because numbers were flagging in the US. We now know that they've gone to an ad-funded model. And even though, as you said, Finn, they've got a reasonable share of market in some corners of APAC, the argument has to be how practical is it to produce good, you know, high quality content in local languages, and there are a lot of local languages. So surely that's got to be a bit of a barrier to entry for international players, unless you've got the right partnerships set up, right? I suppose go Disney and Hotstar. That's why that's worked well in Asia.
I think as well, there's a balance, right? So iFlix tried this and raised a bunch of money and partnered with a bunch of studios and tried it. And then they effectively, because of the fragmentation, I'm simplifying big time, but they overextended in different markets. And so then you have a little bit of content in a lot of places that actually doesn't maybe move the needle on paid subscriber base, and you don't get the critical mass that you need with advertisers. And so that model doesn't stack up. And again, this fragmentation is that's what's hard. There's so many players chasing the consumers who are willing to actually subscribe, and they need local content but not too much local content because the costs are too high. So the economics are pretty
tricky, right? And then, like you said, there's also then the market of people that live in Asia that might not be Asian and want some more international content, like you've just expressed yourself.
Yeah.
So where do we go with it? The next question I've got for both of you is, what do you think will happen with subscriber fatigue in this market? Because that's something that we were talking about. I mean, we still talk about it, but we were talking about it a lot for US and European markets about 5 years ago. Consumers were really starting to get savvy with the amount of money that they were dedicating towards subscription services. Frankly, not just TV subscription services, the job lot. How far away do you think we are in APAC from a bit of subscriber fatigue? Finn, I'll come to you first.
I reckon we're there. I think, and I think you've nailed it with not just TV. I think there is still a large amount of people who still have good old-fashioned cable. I'm one of them. And then pay for the subscriptions on top. You then have Grab or the Uber locally, which has food attached to it. I know we're talking about Food Panda later. They're another one. All of these are offering bundles, subscriptions and everything else, which it's overwhelming, the amount of subscriptions that you need if you want everything bundled in. And I think it's getting to the point where people are looking at credit card statements or however they see their finances and just going, this is crazy. There's so much money going out of the door for all of these free services. So I think subscriber fatigue's very real.
What do you think, Lindsay? And how does that compare with where you think consumers are in, you know, Europe and the US?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that same question, because I think that in the UK and the US, certainly in the UK, I know loads of people that have just looked at the payment outgoings for Netflix, Disney, Spotify, Amazon Prime and gone, do you know what? I can probably just pay for Netflix 1 month to watch something I really want to watch, then cancel it. And then when something good comes on I want to watch, I can get it back for that again, rather than paying this ever increasing amount of money per month and then realizing I haven't watched anything on it for 3 weeks. Well, absolute waste of money. And yeah, it's the same with, you know, there's Deliveroo Plus, there's Uber One, if you want to kind of get a discount on your food delivery. And I signed up for a free trial for it and then forgot to cancel it. Then I was screwed for a month.
Classic.
And I was like, oh, here we go. So I think that's why kind of going down ad-funded routes is going to be, you know, Netflix said it themselves. They realize, despite they've always been adamant that they will never go down the ad-funded route, and then they realize that actually you can't just rely on subscriptions, because I think in Asia they've lost volume, subscriber volume this year versus last year. That'll probably keep happening.
And then that makes me wonder if we'll start to see more sort of pay-as-you-go offerings, exactly what you described earlier on. I think we've talked about this before on other podcast sessions. People will just pay for what they want to view and then move on to the next thing. And I could imagine that business model might actually be hugely popular in a region like APAC, where it is mobile first, where you're talking about people maybe just wanting to see, you know, certain chunks of content or tune into certain sporting events as well.
I think that's the model I've been saying to people I'd love to see, is effectively the iTunes of content. So Super Pumped, is it? The the Uber story that was done in the US. Yep. A lot of friends have said absolutely should watch that. It's brilliant. Can't get it legally here. Don't want to do the iTunes model of $5, $6 an episode. But if there was an app where I could pay $0.20, $0.50 per episode, those economics work for me. And I think more and more I'm seeing that where, you know, you follow people like Scott Galloway in the US, talks a lot about the per capita amount of money being invested in this original programming. That's what I find really weird, being in the ecosystem, that then even as someone willing to pay for that, that they've spent a bucket of money on that they're not recouping in their home market. Why is that not available to me? Same with things like BritBox, which the app in Oz, which takes all of the UK content. How is it you got 25, 30 million people in Oz and that's available there, but you've got a couple of billion across Asia and I can't get that here?
Crazy, isn't it?
That's just weird.
I sort of imagine it must also have something to do with, you know, obviously licensing, talent, contracts, agreements, that sort of thing. I can imagine it's enormously complex. But it's certainly interesting to think about what kind of business models might pop up from a consumer point of view to actually get the content that you want to view. I'm going to move us on. Otherwise, we'll talk about this all day. Mm. We're in one of those moods, I can tell. So, second news story of the week, a Gartner report that was released showing that 60% of the CMOs, so the chief marketing officers surveyed, plan to cut their analytics departments by 2023 due to failed delivery on promised improvements. The same survey also said this point followed 53% of marketers surveyed saying that they use data to inform their decision making. So that's an only 53% of marketers surveying using data to inform decision making. The survey highlighted a number of issues that marketers have when trying to integrate data into decision making. So some of those are that decision makers have a tendency to cherry pick data, which supports a decision they've already made or an opinion that they already hold. Some of the decision makers just outright reject recommendations made by data analysts. And others are just not using the data at all and instead going with a gut feeling. It's quite an overwhelming set of results, really, isn't it? So, Lindsay, I'm going to come to you first on this one. How can data analysts prove the value of data to key marketing decision makers? And I suppose my other question associated with this is, how do we overcome some of the, you know, very obvious flaws, I suppose, in trying to integrate something that's so heavily data-led with a discipline that hitherto hasn't necessarily been very data-driven? How do we get over those prejudices that we've got and, you know, our natural inclination to just trust our own gut feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a shame to read those kind of stats because there's so much talk around digital transformation, certainly during the pandemic. And digital transformation does not come without data. Like, data has to play a massive, massive, massive role in that. And so to hear that key decision makers in these large organizations are just rejecting data is it's a massive shame. And I think that if you remove the data element of marketing, you're left with what used to be called the colouring in club. And no marketer, I don't believe, wants to be part of the colouring in club anymore. They want to be able to use data to be able to effectively inform decisions. And, you know, we'll be talking about this a lot at ATS. It seems weird saying it when this will be going out after we've done it, but never mind.
It's all confusing. It's like a time vortex.
How every panel we do, data will play a really important role in that. And we'll be having marketers on the stage talking about the importance of data. So to hear that the CMOs don't think of data and analytics as important is a disaster, frankly, because it needs to be a fundamental part of what they do. And I think if you are a data analyst, if you work in analytics teams, I don't know how you can counteract that because it's difficult. You know, when you're dealing with senior people, particularly if they've kind of been in the industry for many, many years and they're set in their ways and they think they know better than what the data shows them, it's difficult to change that viewpoint. And that's why you need kind of, I guess, a consensus rather than one person making decisions, because you need to be able to present data and present analytics to a number of people and then they all work out themselves rather than the CMO. I mean, we've all cherry picked data and used data to help better a story. Like, you know, when I used to work in digital, I used to make sure that I'd find the right data for a client report to ensure that it was looking amazing rather than looking absolutely bloody terrible.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's fine, but these are probably related to kind of very, very important business decisions, and they're being, it's being ignored. And that's a shame. I keep saying shame, but it is a shame.
Finn, I know you're going to have a lot of opinions on this because it's quite, you know, in part bread and butter stuff for you. But I guess the thing that I'm wondering about is, so, you know, subsequent to the questions I've posed to Lindsay, I'm wondering if it's also a case that perhaps data analytics in marketing, despite the fact that we spend all our time talking about it and have done for a number of years, is it considered a fairly fresh discipline if you were to look, stand back and look at the marketing discipline overall? And is it that perhaps we just haven't come to grips with the value of data in that context enough yet, or culturally organisations just aren't taking it seriously enough yet because, like Lindsay said, there's still a bit of a prejudice towards thinking that marketing is this nice fluffy add-on discipline that you have, you know, when you've got the money to have it.
So yes, I'll start with that again. So I was thinking about this and I actually think it's a bit of a dichotomy in that you have a lot of marketers who treat the data as you describe, sort of it's fresh, it's new, it's you know, not necessarily trusted. And then you have, I think you now have a lot of marketers who view the data that they do get as kind of a hygiene factor. And this kind of, this whole report to me seems a bit like it lands somewhere in the middle. Like, we don't track it properly and then we don't believe what comes from the stuff we do do, and then we get the results from what we do, but we don't necessarily use them. So it's like a load of sort of contradictory opinions in there. But yeah, I mean, look, I've been doing this for far too long, and I've met maybe three clients in 20 plus years who actually track things properly. And most will go to the nearest metric they can find. And sometimes that nearest metric can be a million miles away. Like, I've worked with clients who will hand on heart tell you, you know, we can take clicks as a proxy for conversions or sales. And they're going, you've got a 20-page application process. How do you take a proxy on clicks? That's just not a thing. That's like a retailer taking footfall as a proxy for sales. It's just completely nonsensical. So, I don't know. It's upsetting to see this, but it's entirely unsurprising. And I think some people have fallen into this space where they just think they've got everything they need, and others are very accepting of not having the right data, and others yet again are just going, screw it, I'll go with what my gut feel says.
Hmm. I think as well, my experience of working agency side, and also from like close friends of mine that work brand side, there is still and this report highlights that very clearly, a disconnect between marketing and then the data part of marketing. And the marketing analytics team will often work in a bit of a silo, and they'll just be told to just do data, and they will pull whatever they can and then share it with the other team, and they'll go, well, what is this? This is of no use to me. This is no help to me. And people that work in digital, they are used to dealing with data. So if you work brand side, and you work, this does not apply to every brand, but certainly experiences that I've had, you're dealing with data already in your own kind of day-to-day job, and you have a marketing analytics team that are coming in and saying to you, this is what you need to do.
Look,
and you're like,
data.
Well, I've actually got this far more useful data that's been delivered to me directly from my partners. I don't know where you got that from, so I'm going to ignore that completely. So there's definitely, I think there was this notion of, we need marketing analytics, but then we don't know what to do with them, how to integrate them, so we just kind of haven't. And now we kind of go, well, that's not actually useful to me, so I don't need that anymore.
I could completely see how that can happen, right? Because if you are going to ever survey anyone, firstly, you need to be looking at who you're surveying. You need to be looking at the way you've asked those questions. There's just so much granularity that's required in order for you to interpret the results appropriately. And then let's say you act on the results of that survey, and then you maybe survey again in another 6 months or 12 months' time to see how you're going. You've got to make sure that all of that is controlled and routine, and you know, and has some integrity to it. And that requires a bit of discipline, requires a bit of investment. And like you've just said, Lindsay, you can imagine how even at the point when large businesses, like for example, agency holding groups, have said, right, we're going to invest in a data analytics team, and we've also obviously got our sort of operational staff working very closely with tech platforms to glean data from those those, you know, the outcome of those advertising and marketing campaigns, and you all need to just work together. It's just not that easy, right? There just needs to be a bridge built between the two. Otherwise, none of it's ever going to make any sense.
Right, and that's the people in the room. So, like, in the last 48 hours, I've been talking to people about retail media, and everyone always talks about the fact that you have, like, Woolworths in Australia now with Cartology, and the point is made often that those budgets are given out to the partners as trade marketing before it even hits the CMO. So you look at everything we're talking about, that's from the CMO down. It doesn't account for if Unilever have dropped $100 million with Woolies and they're on every poster site in every store across the nation and the sales go up, the CMO could be sitting there going, I'm golden. Check me out. And then
done nothing.
Right, exactly. And it's completely unrelated. And this is part of the thing, I think, that's the massive challenge in marketing as a whole is the silos they operate in. And I think digital has always had that, where digital has great data, but they're not looking at, you know, again, 5 million, 10 million bucks on a TV campaign. The search queries went up. And again, just sitting there going, we appeared on more searches, we got greater click-through, greater conversion, aren't we awesome? So I think this the whole thing here is because a lot of marketers aren't getting a holistic, complete picture, that's why people revert to gut and just kind of move along and we'll go with this one.
And arguably tactics that they've used before, whatever they might be, whether those are data-driven or not. Finn, just quick question to you. You mentioned that in your 20-odd years of working in the business, you've only come across, you know, two or three brands that have really used data to an impressive extent. Was there any similarities between those brands? Are we talking big brands? Are we talking particular verticals? Or there were no similarities?
Big brands. Oh, sorry. Big brands and small brands. people who really invested ahead of the curve and saw similarities in early channels with things they'd done previously. So Amex were a really big early mover in search marketing, and I'm going back far too many years, like 17, 18 years. They took a lot of the learnings from direct mail, and we did some really cool stuff with those guys where we literally, like, we modeled spend from consumers for 2 years based on whether someone came through an application on the term credit card versus credit cards. There's like a 40% difference on spending. But just a really, like I say, holistic top line view. And again, that came from the analysis that they'd done for years and years through direct mail, what different databases were giving them in card members, what those card members were worth over time. So very old school techniques applied to digital. And those guys, financial services have always, I think, been one step ahead because they're themselves born in data. I think what's interesting now is the CPG, FMCG guys getting more involved and more through the line. But I don't think they're there yet.
Do you think that digital native brands do it better? Or actually, because they haven't got, you know, Amex is a great example, they actually use legacy tactics to bring them into the modern world. I guess digital native brands haven't got that to draw back on, but they operate in a world that where they're ready to go, basically. Is it improvement?
I think in many cases it is, but one of the interesting things I think we're seeing now is that things like search and social advertising have now become such a hygiene factor that the smarts aren't put into them in the way that they were when they were new and shiny, whether you're D2C or a big brand. And so, again, bit of a dichotomy in there. I think some are just throwing search and social ads because they just think they need to be on Instagram or Facebook or whatever or be there for the search results, but not looking at what that actually delivers. But others who are really penny pinching and watching what they're spending and very nimble. Absolutely. I think, you know, brands that are built on really good standards of analytics and understanding and sort of woe to go tracking of every metric, they're, you know, great scalable businesses.
Speaking of, I'm going to move us on to third news story of today, which is that Food Panda delivery app. So Food Panda, for our European listeners, are actually a subsidiary of Delivery Hero, which is the German-based delivery app. And Food Panda have launched their own ads platform called Panda Ads, great name, which is basically their suite of ad tech and martech tools. And that will include obviously Foodpanda app for advertising, digital marketing assets, and a partnerships program, which they're expanding delivering in part through a partnership with Group M. And of course, they make a promise to enable brands to reach a wider audience of customers in a digital environment. Now, what do we make of Panda Ads? Go on, Finn, first up. You can't answer yes to this one.
Really would be, and that's not really, can't I answer yes? It's really, do we need another one? Why? I don't get it. Like, I don't understand what this is for. It's similar to Grab as the super app, Grab Ads. I use Grab 10 times a day, was with someone earlier who used it the same amount, and we were trying to remember three people who'd advertised it in the last week or two. I'm there to order food. I'm there to order groceries, and Foodpanda is brilliant. I love it. I think their grocery delivery in Singapore specifically is top of the line in terms of half hour, 40 minute delivery. It's absolutely great. I don't get the ads piece. There's this whole rush at the moment to, we're going to have quality inventory. One of the things that Asia is missing is quality advertisers. So if you go to YouTube, their bumper ads, which are the premium ads, they tend not to be sold out in APAC. If you go to Twitter and their top of page ads, which again are the premium video ads, they tend not to be sold out. Having run some of those those partnerships when I was at Dentsu, I can tell you it's a struggle to find the advertisers for those. And if you use YouTube for any amount of time, you see a lot of Monday.com ads, a lot of get rich quick, a lot of real estate ads. There are not that many advertisers who really chase premium placements. And so it's more ad inventory. Great. One of the questions I've got about Netflix when they launch is, who's advertising? Because either I'm going to subscribe on a cheaper plan and they're not going to show me ads, or they're going to show me Android games or games I can install on my Apple TV, which are not fitting with the brand.
Absolutely not.
Not fitting with the halo, and not what they promised.
Exactly.
They said they'll deliver a different advertising experience. Who's advertising? Am I going to see 15 Apple iPhone ads in a row? Because Apple, Huawei, maybe Oppo, maybe Samsung, outside of the handset makers, there aren't that many advertisers. And especially now LinkedIn served me more jewellery ads than known to anyone. Lots of Chanel, lots of Van Cleef & Arpels, which is weird by itself, but that's a different podcast.
I can confirm Finn is not wearing a lot of jewellery.
Certainly no diamonds. Send me diamonds. But it's just a gap, right? It's a real gap in terms of, it's great to create all these quality ad placements, but the ones we've got aren't full. So we either take quality ad placements and massively devalue them for the publishers and the other advertisers who are there, which screws with the economics of the publishers, or we don't have ads in them. So where does Foodpanda fit in that? Because if it's got my attention, and when's it got my attention? I've ordered my dumplings and my lettuce to be delivered. Like, I might log in twice to see where my guy on a scooter is, and is he 5 minutes away or 10 minutes away, or is he lost somewhere in my condo? When am I watching an ad? And also, same with Grab. When I am watching an ad, when am I interacting with the ad? Because I'm busy. I'm waiting for my shopping, or I'm in a car going somewhere.
Is it just an attempt to build a little mini walled garden for Foodpanda, like a mini discreet buying environment? And is it going to benefit anyone?
I mean, yes, I guess it is that. It is doing that. They want – it's a way to get more – potentially more first-party data. But at the same time, I just opened, because you're talking about using Grab. I've used Grab loads since I've been here. I've been here 4 days and I don't remember seeing one single ad. And I just opened it and I was like, oh, there's the ad. I didn't even really register that it was there. And yeah. I was like, oh, yeah, okay. But what makes me laugh, like, I've had this conversation, some of the stuff you're talking about, you know, the Netflix and Foodpanda and everything else, I've had this conversation in many different contexts so much in the past few days. And actually, I was having a chat with Foodpanda and they themselves don't really get the returns from digital advertising that they get from, like, they're going back into door drops and flyering, and they love out of home. There's an amazing food panda, people of Singapore will probably have seen it, by Raffles Place, that flashes and goes pink when you go past it. That's the kind of stuff they like doing. They don't even like doing the stuff that they're now trying to monetize. So that for me is an interesting, you know, if you don't do it yourself, then why would other premium brands go and do it? And also, if Panda Ads isn't integrated with any ad tech solutions, then obviously it's with GroupM, then it's another platform for someone have to upload ads into and create ads for, and they're just not going to bother.
Just, I think as well, GroupM partner with everyone. Like, I've not seen an ad platform that launches without GroupM putting a stake in the ground, whether it's Lazada, Shopee. I actually don't know on Shopee, I'm just assuming. But, like, whenever an ad platform launches, the PR department at GroupM kick in, and so they can turn up to a pitch with a bunch of logos and say, look, we did this, we showed this. So I don't think that's a thing. Like, that's hygiene factor, right? And walled garden, who wants a walled garden?
well, presumably nobody except the company themselves.
So I go back to the first conversation we had about subscription fatigue, and I actually think whether it's Netflix retreating to advertising or Food Panda, I think everyone has realised that there is massive fatigue, that people are looking, and whether it's $15 a month to Food Panda to get free delivery and you realise that actually you're better off paying whatever per delivery, or whether it's Netflix lowering subscription price. I think everyone was very holier than thou and anti-advertising whilst consumers were paying one or two things. But all of a sudden, when you're paying for Adobe Photoshop and Canva and whatever, and Microsoft 365 and GoDaddy and WordPress, hence my morning setting up website, right? Again, that's another podcast. There's so many subscriptions, and it's death by a thousand cuts. And so I think everyone's trying to put in that insurance layer of advertising, but the advertising isn't there.
It's not an insurance layer. And as you said, there's a lack of quality advertising. And actually the Netflix comment, you know, the big concern about someone like Netflix going ad funded is, well, who's going to advertise on it? And are they going to do a good job advertising on it? You know, their CPMs have been tied to $65. I'm assuming that's in the US, because no one's going to pay that over here.
You wouldn't think so.
You pay between $2 to $4 in Indonesia for ZTV CPM. So it's not going to happen over here. But at the same time, that means that there's no impetus to produce quality adverts. And there's also kind of this notion, and I've had this chat with a couple of people, that maybe because there's just so much demand for goods and services, advertisers don't feel the need to put the effort into advertising and making a quality experience, because they just need the name to be seen, because someone's going to use it and buy it because the population explosion is so ridiculous. I had this chat with a couple of people that have said that seems legitimate. Based on the quality of advertising people are seeing, that seems like it could be a legitimate
strategy.
Thing. And you need to think in all these environments, like, you need to be able to provide a good experience, almost like a gamified experience. Certainly the likes of Netflix, you do not want to detract from the experience they are there to view, certainly kind of in the CTV environment. Yet all the ads that I see, this is not just exclusive to Asia, but actually kind of, you know, back home as well, they're taking me out of my experience and making me go, oh, what the hell was that? That's ruined everything now. Like, in gaming, we talk about it in the gaming a lot, they're trying to gamify and get brands to really kind of provide an experience that's akin to what they're experiencing on the game. Finn has just turned his laptop round to show the jewellery ad that he gets on LinkedIn.
Cartier now on LinkedIn.
I mean, you, what kind of...
Have you been buying a lot of jewellery?
I think I'm profiled as a very successful professional woman.
I think you might be. It's Fiona Handyman, isn't it?
It's my drag name.
But yeah, I mean, we're veering off into all sorts of territory now, but that is an interesting point, right, about the quality of advertising that you're serving. And presumably no brand wants to be associated with poor quality advertising. No business, no company wants to be associated with poor quality advertising. So even though Food Panda launching their ads platform, they're obviously hoping it's going to be hugely successful, and they don't probably want the type of advertising that's just going to irritate consumers, because it will mean that they will leave and they'll go to an alternative. They have plenty of competition. We know that Netflix, where we're sitting now, we know that Netflix will be cringing if they're in a position in, I don't know, 3 months' time where they have to tolerate poor quality advertising because it just goes so against their brand. However, if it's bringing them loads of spondoolies, they won't care.
That's exactly it. They won't.
But won't they? Like they this won't is because, the thing at a well, fundamental, like would Apple accept it?
Sorry, there's a caveat to that comment I've just made then. They won't care as long as their subscription revenue is sustained and growing and as long as they're making some good money off the advertising revenue, then they won't care. Because I guess they'll think that consumers have self-selected. Ah, well, I'm going to deal with the ad-funded model, so I've just got to put up with it.
What if we make ads so bad that everyone goes, oh, I thought that was going to be better, but actually I'd rather pay for the sub instead?
Could happen. We're going off into esoteric territory here, so I'm going to stop us and say that is it for discussion of news stories for the week. Would like to wrap up the podcast, Finn, with just a couple of questions about what you're working on at the moment. Now, we've had a couple of conversations with you about the world of live commerce. Tell us a little bit about live commerce here in APAC and what you're doing.
Yeah, so live commerce is, I think, a really interesting space. Born out of China in about 2016, where some of the walled gardens put in video functionality for sellers to host what a lot of people outside of APAC will think of QVC, HSN, home shopping. It's a lot more interactive than that, but the premise is exactly that. It's someone selling to camera and people buying. That's exploded in China. It now accounts for somewhere between 25% to 33% of all e-commerce is now through live. There's a bunch of huge stats, and we're seeing that expand, and I'm starting to see that expand. So I've worked in the space specifically for about 18 months, and as someone who's been doing the digital side for a long time and was working with brands, both coming online and especially coming online around search and performance, for the first time it feels like a born in Asia product that will actually go global, but I think a little bit differently than the way it's done in China. So in China it's through a few key platforms. Already in the rest of the world, we're seeing different things pop up. So you've got some great companies like Firework, Bambooza, who are working on either direct-to-consumer video or video on brand.com. You've got these interesting live marketplaces like a business called Whatnot, which just got a lot of funding from Alphabet and DST and some of the big guys. Super great pop shop, different marketplaces, which are just all around like makeup demos and selling cosmetics or whatnots, all around collectibles. And then you've got the big boys coming in. So TikTok coming in with live, Amazon and other platforms. So where I'm working is working with brands who want to try and address that, especially those who've been successful in China. So you've got people like L'Oreal, Lego, and some of the big brands who are easily doing over $1 billion in sales in China just through their brand stores. And so same as with search back in the day where, you know, CEO or CMO then turns around and goes, oh, cool, the rest of you, go and do that everywhere else. Our thesis is sort of that's what we think is going to happen in the live space. So it's exciting.
And what, so, you know, born in China, popular in no doubt in other parts of Asia, what are you seeing in terms of, you know, picking up the functionality and technology? Would you say it's, you know, parts of Southeast Asia are completely immersed in it already? Is there someone that's moving a bit faster than somewhere else?
So I don't think anywhere is anywhere near as immersed as China. They're so far ahead. It's like e-commerce in 2003 with the US just being country miles ahead of everyone else. What we're seeing is sort of a distinction in a lot of the Southeast Asian markets. You have China light platforms, so Lazada, Shopee, AliExpress, platforms like Viki in Vietnam, who are launching platforms that look and feel exactly like what's happening in China. You then, on the other end of the spectrum, have the more Western platforms who are treating it a little bit like a live event, which in my mind is kind of doomed to fail. So the whole success from China is that this happens, you're watching a feed and in one or two clicks or pushes, however you phrase it, you've ordered, you've purchased, you've bought. Whereas the platforms in the West, like Twitter did a trial last year with Walmart, it was hosted by Jason Derulo. I don't know what that was. They called it live commerce, but I don't know where you bought, I don't know where you transacted, I don't know where you watched. And so if I'm confused, I think the consumer was probably confused. And I think the whole thing with most of the non-Asia markets is to try and stop thinking about this like an event and fronted by a celebrity and think of it as business as usual. And that's what's happened in China and where the success is. So a lot of the brands in China now have at least one or two brand channels doing up to 18 hours a day. So it's always on.
Amazing. I reckon it's probably the word live that's confusing Western sort of audiences and platforms. As soon as the word live pops up, they think, oh, okay, someone famous.
Yeah.
Just from an execution point of view.
Yeah.
And whereas the focus really is on commerce.
Yeah, I think the big thing is everyone not everyone, but a lot of people outside of China default to influencer. And if I could remove one thing from live commerce, it would be influencers. Influencers, sweeping generalization, but influencers are interested in selling influencers. We did research that shows people who follow scripts do better than people who don't. Influencers don't follow scripts. They screw the economics up because they're on camera and they need to be paid. If they're on camera, they tend to want at least three people behind the camera, so makeup, lighting, manager, whoever else. Whereas what we found really successful in China and other markets across APAC is it's actually better to go to the Selfridges or Takashimaya department store and take the person doing a makeup demo who's already doing this for 8 hours a day, but putting them in front of a camera. They have the product knowledge, they're not expensive, they actually care about the product, and it's a proper sale. Rather than having someone who hasn't seen the product before, you give it to them and they're selling it through their winning personality.
Yeah, we have enough of winning personalities in the world, don't we?
Too many, far too many.
That totally makes sense. It was, I think it was one of the first conversations that we had a couple of months ago, Finn, so about live commerce. You were educating me on what's happening in China. It was really interesting. We're going to be fascinated to see how this particular part of the industry unfolds in the coming 12 to 24 months. We have run out of time. Thank you very much, Finn, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you. Loved every minute of it.
Excellent. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.